A coalition of concerned Catholics speaks out about allegations of sex abuse within the church. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect, and thanks for being with us. Just ahead this hour, we'll tell you why local parishioners say the diocese here in North Florida needs to do more to restore trust. What are your thoughts about the sex abuse scandal globally within the Catholic Church? That's what we're talking about today. Call us up right now. It's 549-2937. Then later, we speak with author John Paul on a figure of fascination around the world, Turkish cleric Fethullah Gulen. But first this morning, years after the first reports were made public, new revelations about the child sex abuse scandal within the Catholic Church continue to come out. Here in Florida, it's been more than a year since the launch of a statewide investigation into these allegations at the hands of Catholic priests, and it has opened the door for victims of past crimes to come forward and share their stories of trauma and abuse. At the same time, local Catholics say their North Florida diocese is not being proactive enough in dealing with the scandal. We decided to learn more, so right now we're welcoming Joe Lowry. He's vice president with the local Coalition of Concerned Catholics. Joe, thanks for joining us. We appreciate you being here.
Glad to be here.
What are your thoughts about the sex abuse scandal within the Catholic Church and the statewide investigation? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaNJax. And our Facebook page is open to you as well. So why did you form this coalition, and what is the nature of your concerns about the local diocese, Joe?
Well, a year and a half ago, our Bishop Estevez promised us a report to the faithful, and he promised us transparency and accountability. In the ensuing time, we have only had two names revealed and hardly any information concerning the history of this within our diocese.
You're saying two names of priests
who
have been accused.
Offenders. No, we have been decided that they were.
Okay.
All right. We have also been told informally, but not publicly, that there might be anywhere from 7 to 10 in total. Considering the age of this diocese, 450 years, and the fact that we've had three bishops in over the last 30 years, there should be based on everything else, there's a lot more to go on. 2 years ago, only 35 bishops had posted any list of priests. Today, there are more than 6,500 names in the country.
These are the names of priests that have been released by a diocese around America,
exactly,
you're saying. Okay.
Exactly.
Now, we reached out to the St. Augustine Diocese, and this is the statement from them. They say they've been cooperating fully with the state's attorney general in her investigation of the seven dioceses of Florida. They say they're anxious for the investigation to be completed so that they can publish the names of any priests who've been credibly accused. We want that report, they say, to be accurate and complete, and we are working with state investigators. Also, remember, the Diocese of St. Augustine was once the entire state of Florida east of the Apalachicola River, so some cases have been reported in other areas of the state. She says, this is from spokeswoman Kathleen Bagg. She says investigators are sorting through them for their list of cases. We are not going to report names, she says, until the state's investigation is complete. Why aren't you satisfied with that?
Because in most states, in many areas, there's been no impediment to the church taking its own action to report these names. And once they have, then other people realize that they are also victims and come forward. And so more names can at least be investigated. They are not providing enough information so that more victims can come forward and tell where they know what parish the priest was in, what years he was there, who was bishop at the time, and so on.
Often victims don't come forward till many years after the abuse takes place. Often the statute of limitations has expired. Let's point out, in Florida, there is no limit for reporting abuse if it happened when the victim was younger than 16. Victims can call a hotline as well. It's 1-800-96-ABUSE. They even have a website at the statewide level for people to enter their information. So as the state investigates, what we've learned through the years when it comes to this crisis, Joe, is that it is global. There was a recent Vatican abuse summit trying to better protect minors within the Catholic Church. The office in the Vatican that's processing these complaints has seen 1,000 cases reported from around the world just this year alone. So the cases continue to be coming forward. So what, in your view, then, should the St. Augustine Archdiocese do that they aren't doing right now?
The St. Augustine Diocese is doing little or nothing in terms of getting the information out. The average age of the person, of the victim, when they finally report, is 52 years old. And these are offenses that took place 35 years ago or more. Now, I was personally acquainted back in another diocese with at least five people who were likely victims, including one that whose report required the priest to be just quietly transferred to another parish, which was the common practice throughout the country. The Attorney General in Missouri has characterized the various bishops and dioceses there as being more concerned with protecting the priest and the offenders than they were with the victims themselves. Pennsylvania's Attorney General has provided a great deal of information. I would just invite people to investigate. Just put down, go do a Google search, and you will get an avalanche of information. The Buffalo Diocese, the bishop had a closet with names that he was not disclosing to anybody until a whistleblower in the diocese staff came forward with it and published it. That bishop has resigned.
It's 549-2937 as we discuss the sex abuse scandal within the Catholic Church. If you're just tuning in, we've already read on air a statement from the St. Augustine Diocese making clear to WJCT that they are working with statewide investigators, the State Attorney General's office, as they investigate this matter. Let me ask you on from a bigger picture, are you a lifelong Catholic?
I was a cradle Catholic, as they say. I was baptized Catholic as an infant, and I've remained a Catholic. I'm a weekly Mass attender.
Is it difficult to stay loyal to the Church, given that this is a scandal that has gone on for decades now? How do you square your faith against the institutional response to child sex abuse around the world?
My issue is more with our hierarchy, our bishops, our archbishops, and even our cardinals, and even the Vatican, and the way they've handled this matter. I do not allow it to interfere with the practice of my faith. If they don't want me there at Mass, they need to invite me. However, I have been advised by a nurse who was accompanying our bishop that I should leave the church. I don't believe that she was a member of that parish, nor was I. I went there and I gave two words to the bishop: transparency and accountability. And upon that, I was asked to leave the church. I will not leave the church.
Who asked you to leave the church?
This bishop apparently has a private nurse accompanying him to his visits to this. This was another parish. It was Our Lady Star of the Sea a couple months ago.
Let me ask you a more philosophical question. Critics of the Catholic Church and its culture of secrecy around the celibacy of priests have shown in their research, particularly a late researcher named Sipe, whose work was discussed at length in the Academy Award-winning film Spotlight. They noted that, according to his research, about 50% of priests are not celibate, but that this is basically looked the other way at within the church. It's kept secret. And that culture of secrecy is what allowed the proliferation of child sex abuse cases. So given that research, what are your thoughts about calls for the Catholic Church to allow priests to marry and also to ordain women? Critics of this scandal have said that that could have a dramatic impact on reducing child sex abuse cases.
For 1,000 years, there was no requirement in our faith for celibacy. For the last 900-some years, they have had celibacy. I think it has that. The origination of the celibacy thing had a lot more to do with protecting the property of the church from being passed on to family members or others, I believe, than it did to any religious purpose. But again, I disagree with that, but I'm not a qualified person. We have plenty of canon lawyers and others who can advise us, you know, as to why the reason is. But I think that there is I'm not sure what the observance of celibacy is among priests. I have no idea. But it certainly needs to be limited. Anything they do needs not to be limited to vulnerable people like children and teens, you know. Or
and what about Pope Francis and his response to the crisis? How do you rate him on this? He is he is now saying some priests should be allowed to marry. What about that?
Well, I have visited parishes in remote areas where they had Mass once a year. All right, once a year. That and to a Catholic, being able to receive the Eucharist is an important thing to us. And you're a Catholic in a remote area, and you can only receive, you can only have a priest visit once a year, so you're deprived of the Eucharist. We have to do something about that in these areas if we want to maintain a religion. Otherwise, people are just going to leave the church, and a lot of them have, perhaps.
Not you, though. You're still a parishioner.
No, they cannot run me off.
And certainly there are millions of Catholics all over the world that are following this, you know. The Vatican office has been struggling with this for, gosh, two decades, and are pledging transparency, accountability, justice for children. They have come a long way, in other words, I guess, is what I'm saying, from their initial response.
Well, going back to John Paul II, who has been proclaimed a saint against my belief, let's say, but he was actually an enabler of this awful person who founded the Legionnaires of Christ and was a serial abuser and so forth, and who ended up dying here in Jacksonville after being disgraced. All right, all this information about all the offenders, including Cardinal McCarrick, was taken to the Vatican, and very little was done until just very lately.
A defrocked priest named McCarrick, we learned, recently relocated here to this area. However, the diocese is telling WJCT he's not being housed on church property, and they have no idea where he's living. We did want to note that as well. By the way, we have Kathleen Bagg on the line calling into the show from the St. Augustine Diocese. Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for calling in.
Hi, Melissa.
Okay, go ahead.
I'd love to clear up some misunderstandings. McCarrick has been defrocked, and the church's hands are tied. He is considered a citizen like anybody else. He has not been found guilty in a court of law, so even law enforcement can't limit his movements around the country as a public citizen. The diocese can say that we do not have him on any of our church property, nor have we made any arrangements for him to be on church-owned property. We can't say where he is because we can't track his movements, just like law enforcement, but we can only say that we would not harbor him or provide him with a place to stay.
Understood. Let me ask you, Kathleen, as a follow-up, what about the concern from some of your parishioners that the diocese here needs to be more transparent about this issue, as other dioceses and bishops around the country have been, just more forthcoming with information? What's your response to that?
Well, our diocese, believe it or not, back in 1989, created one of the very first diocesan review boards by lay professionals to review any allegations that come forward. That was in 89, and we learn a lot more. We have learned a lot more over the years, and I think that we've been pretty responsive. As I've told Mr. Lowry in the past, we report the allegations to law enforcement. We have shared the information with the news media and with our parishioners when there are credible allegations that come forward. We haven't had a lot, thank God, but any one case is one case too many. I think what gets confusing is, as you mentioned earlier, the Diocese of St. Augustine used to include the entire state of Florida. Since then, we now have seven established dioceses in Florida. Cases may come up that say it's part of the Diocese of St. Augustine when the abuse occurred, but then we're working with other dioceses to make sure those cases are taken care of. And we do report them along with the diocese where that person was currently serving. I know that's kind of confusing, but that's one of the things that the state of Florida, in their investigation, I mean, they see priest name come up in their hotline, their tip line. They see people calling in about certain priests, and they're trying to hunt it down to see where did the abuse occur and did it ever get reported by that particular diocese. So it's a lot of trying to clarify the list that the state attorney general will eventually be releasing. But we have always provided those names to the news media and to our parishes when they come up.
Understood. Let me ask you, Kathleen, some of the questions I asked Mr. Lowry. The late Richard Sipe was a leading expert on clergy sex abuse, and as I said a few minutes ago, his work was highlighted in the Academy Award-winning film Spotlight, the Boston Globe investigation into sex abuse among Catholic priests in Boston. That investigation sparked the global awareness of this. He pointed out that based on 30 years of research, between 4 and 6% of all priests are sexual abusers of children. So given that, is it credible to say that only two priests within this archdiocese could be credibly accused?
Well, I'm not saying that only two priests. I'm just saying the only two that we've reported that I've had the information to report was in 2005 with Jesuit priest Neil Carr and William Malone last year that we reported. There are other cases of allegations that have come forward, and like I said, they're around the state of Florida. So there is more than two priests. We do have more than two priests on our full list, but the priests on our list, for the majority, have already been reported to secular media. It's just a matter of compiling the list and making sure our list is as complete as possible, along with the findings of the state of Florida. It's a list thing. It's not a lack of reporting and a lack of acknowledgement and making people aware. As far as the Sipes report, I don't think that you can say celibacy is the cause of abuse. I think if that were the case, we wouldn't have abuse in homes by family members. We wouldn't have abuse by other married clergy and other faiths. We wouldn't have abuse by the medical community, by the sports community. So I don't think that you can say celibacy is the cause of pedophilia.
Well, no, that's not what he said. He said that because up to 50% of priests, according to his research, are not celibate, that a culture of secrecy has mushroomed within the Catholic Church around the world, and that it's a culture of secrecy that led to the looking the other way at the sexual abuse of children. So it's more nuanced than that. What about that research?
I can't speak to the research because I haven't seen it. I can only speak to how we've dealt with cases in our diocese. I do think that there is a world problem with this issue, and I think it's going to take many people coming together to try to solve it, including members of our community, including members of our own church. We don't have all the answers, but I can't attest to those figures because we're not experiencing that kind of figure in our diocese.
And this is Kathleen Bagg with us from the diocese. Joe, would you like to respond?
I would just like to say that if other dioceses have been able to come forward with names and details, and including one in Florida, the Diocese of St. Petersburg, which has released a list of their credibly accused offenders, then why are we using an excuse that an attorney general investigation is preventing us from doing the same thing here? Now, in Naples, there's a diocese there that is taking the same position as our own Diocese of St. Augustine is taking and not releasing much information. A local television station contacted the Attorney General's office, and the Attorney General's office said no one needs our permission to release any information that they have. End of story.
Kathleen.
Well, that is based on what that television station learned. The St. Petersburg Diocese released those names several years ago before this investigation even started. The other six dioceses of Florida had not released names in the form of a list, but we have published the names with secular media and with our parishioners when those names are available to us as soon as we can substantiate credible allegations. We don't want to release a list unless it's going to be comprehensive. We want it to be accurate. Why just throw names up on there if we're going to learn that the state investigation has learned of other names that belong to our diocese, but the men served in other areas of the state?
Because shouldn't parishioners know if someone that has access to children has been accused?
Absolutely, and that's why we send that out to all of our parishioners. If an allegation comes forward that's credible, we send a notice that goes out into every bulletin in the diocese. We also send a news release to secular media to report it there. We also you know, and we reach out to the victims of those areas. So
okay.
And not to cut you off,
Kathleen, just stand by one moment, simply because we have a lot of other folks waiting on hold. Don't go away, though. Let's take a few more calls. Let's go now to John in Jacksonville. Go ahead, John. You're on the air.
Good morning, Melissa. How are you?
Good, thanks. Thanks for calling.
Good. So very interesting conversation. Thank you for finally getting to it. We represent one of the victims, and I almost couldn't disagree more with some of the claims by the diocese on how these have been handled. You know, if you or I make a mistake, it's in our employee file. Well, when this isn't a mistake, you know, these were abuse, and these files weren't even going into the employee files. They were going into a separate locked box, and, you know, until Florida opens up window litigation, you know, the window of litigation again, like other states have, and until these are addressed, we can't even get a response back from the diocese attorney. You know, what?
Wait a minute. Let me ask you two things. One, you represent a victim who was abused as a child. Is that correct to say?
Correct.
And okay.
Correct.
And two, what? Explain a little bit more what you're saying about a window to allow litigation. Because it's my understanding, if the victim was younger than 16 when the alleged abuse happened, there is no statute of limitations. Can you explain a little more what you're saying?
Certainly, it depends on when it became known and all of that. But regardless, we don't need to cap these things off at 16. But as I understand it, there still are, and we're still getting defenses of statute of limitations on these cases because the statute opening up these cases specifically, you know, from what would be a typical statute of limitations. Is kind of being used against victims. Texas, New York, California just proposed and passed window legislation that actually opens up these specific claims for a year or two to let all of these victims, as your guest said, you know, most of them are 50 before they finally have the courage and to come forward, largely because the church has finally ousted their abusers or they've passed away.
So what, in your view, then, should the diocese be, how should they be responding? And we'll go back to Kathleen in a moment.
Yeah, they've got to be, you know, more aggressive with handling these claims. And it's the you know, our client experienced them going with in-house therapy. And guess what? In-house therapy was sharing some of the information with those making decisions. And if that's not collusive behavior, I don't know what is. And it's just, you know, we're just getting into this. But it's been highly disturbing on top of, you know, the most depraved acts one can imagine.
All right. That's Attorney John Phillips, who just called into the show. Thank you, John. Let's go back to our spokeswoman for the diocese, Kathleen Bagg. Kathleen, what about those comments from the attorney representing one of the victims in these cases?
Any allegation of abuse that comes forward, we turn it right over to law enforcement for them to investigate. The diocese does not investigate these cases. We're not investigators. The state needs to do that. We do not provide in-house counseling that is then also shared with our review board or with other mechanisms in the diocese. We offer them assistance to find counseling. We will pay for their counseling. They choose who they want to go to. So to think that we're providing in-house counseling, we don't have in-house counselors that provide that service.
What about the research, though, that shows that pedophilia, that counseling is has limited effectiveness at best in treating pedophilia, and that these are heinous crimes?
That is true, Melissa. I don't know that you can cure anybody that has that is a pedophile. That is why we remove any clerics that have been credibly accused of allegations of sexual child abuse. They do not serve in our church. We do not move them around from parish to parish. Those are our policies. And that's why I can comfortably say that we do not have a bishop, a seminarian, a priest, a deacon, religious serving in this diocese who have been credibly accused.
We're getting emails and tweets about this. Here's one from a listener. Joe writes, I truly believe the Catholic Church has been infiltrated by a group of sociopathic child predators. The cover-up has destroyed the church's credibility. I am a cradle Catholic, but I have left the Catholic Church. Certainly some Catholics have. Joe Lowry, you have not.
I refuse to allow the behavior of any priest, bishop, cardinal, whatever, to deny me my faith. I treasure it, and I do not believe, I am not claiming that I'm a better Catholic. I am not, all right? I just am a loyal Catholic. That's all I can say. The faith is too precious to me to allow any bishop, particularly this one, to interfere with the practice of my faith. If he wants me to leave the church, he can invite me personally. He knows how to reach me.
Now, let me reiterate for those that missed it earlier, the state investigation into this is not only focused on the Catholic Church, but law enforcement wants to hear about any institutional abuse from youth groups, schools, other churches. You can call the hotline at 1-800-96-ABUSE. And we want to thank both Joe Lowry with the Coalition of Concerned Catholics and Kathleen Bagg representing the Diocese of St. Augustine, both of them with us on the show this morning. Thank you both for being with us today. We appreciate your time.
Thank you for the opportunity to be here. I am a flawed candidate, but I've been told I have a great face for radio, and here I am.
All right. Well, thank you both so much. We're going to take a quick break, and up next, a conversation with author John Paul about Fethullah Gulen, an internationally renowned Turkish cleric living in exile here in the U.S. That's next.
Fertility clinic in a downtown Brooklyn high-rise. I don't have any fertility issues, at least none that I know of yet anyways, outside of the fact that my wife doesn't make sperm.
Join us next time for more True Stories Told Live. This week, stories about reconciling the past. That's the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Saturday at noon on 89.9 WJCT.
WJCT and the Florida Theater present Canadian acoustic guitarist, composer, and producer Jesse Cook, performing live at the WJCT Soundstage on Tuesday, January 21st, 2020, at 8 p.m. Jesse Cook blends rumba, flamenco, and elements of new age and jazz to create his uniquely global sound. Don't miss the opportunity to see Jesse Cook live at the WJCT Soundstage. Visit wjct.org/events for more information. Take a drive with us into the blues horizon. The best in classic and modern blues. Every Monday and Wednesday night at 11. Right here on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, Turkish prosecutors have ordered the detention of 176 members of that country's armed forces, they say, over suspected links to a network they blame for a coup attempt in the country. Followers of the U.S.-based religious leader Fethullah Gulen have apparently been swept up in a sustained crackdown in Turkey since the failed coup, which ended in the deaths of 250 people. Now, Gulen is an internationally renowned Turkish cleric living in exile here in the U.S. He's been credited with inspiring a global movement dedicated to scholarship and social enterprise. Gulen was forced out of Turkey, reports say, by that country's dictator, Recep Erdogan. Author John Paul has written Golan's story, and he'll discuss it at a special event tonight in downtown Jacksonville. His book is titled Fethullah Golan, A Life of Hizmet. Dr. John Paul, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much. Great to be with you.
And it's 549-2937 as we discuss the life and work of Fethullah Golan. So Hizmet refers to the Golan movement, correct?
That's right.
And what are the principles of Hizmet?
Yeah, the word means service, very simply. And people inspired by Mr. Golan do three things around the globe in 130 different countries now, starting in Turkey, but everywhere. Mm-hmm. Build schools, mostly math and science academies.
Including River City Science Academy here in Jacksonville.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. They also sponsor social enterprises, that is, businesses to generate wealth, but that also solves social problems. And then the third initiative is to sponsor interreligious dialogue. Mr. Golan is very much an advocate that we need to resolve our problems through talk and through engagement rather than through violence. So he's an advocate of nonviolence.
What are your thoughts about Golan's exile here in America and the actions of the Turkish leader Erdogan?
Mr. Golan has been in the U.S. since 1999, so he knows the country, and he's been grateful for the safe harbor that's been provided here by the United States. His exile was for health reasons, primarily. He is a diabetic, has some cardiac problems, and his doctor at the Mayo Clinic was here. He came here primarily to be near his doctors. Of course, there were political entanglements as well. He has repeatedly been persecuted as a cleric and preacher, perceived as a threat to the state.
Because, and why is that?
Yeah, many people were inspired by him. And anytime in an authoritarian context, dissent arises or another perceived power base arises, authoritarians will try to shut that down.
Is it fair to call Fethullah Golan a more moderate Muslim than Erdogan and his followers in Turkey?
The distinction that I draw is between political Islam, which is Erdogan, that is Islam from the top down, and civil Islam. And Golan advocates for civil Islam, that is Islam from the ground up, primarily through individuals, through families, and then through schools, businesses, the free market, and then with impact on politics. But it's a very different model, and a model that, of course, is completely consistent with democracy, which Mr. Mm-hmm. Golan has been an advocate for throughout his life. He's also been an advocate for media. So in Turkey, people inspired by him built the largest circulation newspaper, became the largest circulation newspaper, Zaman, which means time. And unfortunately, following the coup, Mr. Erdogan shut down Zaman, including many other media outlets, and then seized the assets to be distributed eventually to his cronies. He's perceived as a threat, not because of anything intrinsic to what he says, but because people were inspired by him.
Let me ask you your thoughts about how Golan has figured into domestic scandals. Former Trump advisor Michael Flynn is currently looking at a prison sentence for lying to the FBI.
Yep.
Among other things, he had engaged in controversial lobbying work. That included publishing an opinion piece in The Hill in November of 2016, urging the U.S. to extradite Fethullah Golan. We've also learned that Rudy Giuliani, the president's personal attorney, pushed Trump to hand over Golan to Turkey. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts about this?
Yeah, the Turkish government has spent millions of dollars in a slander and defamation campaign against Mr. Golan. And unfortunately, some people in the U.S. have been complicit with that campaign. You've mentioned a couple of the names. Fortunately, other people in the State Department have had the good sense to recognize that this man is innocent, that he, in fact, is an advocate for dialogue, for peace building in the tradition of the Dalai Lama and Mohandas Gandhi and people like that. And to extradite him would, of course, be, in effect, a death sentence for an innocent individual. And people in the State Department, to this point, have recognized the folly of any such move toward extradition.
As I mentioned a few moments ago, in Turkey, hundreds of people have been detained, members of the country's armed forces, because they're suspected of being Gulen followers. The Turkish dictator Erdogan says Gulen organized a coup in his home country. Did Gulen lead a coup against the Turkish leader?
No, this is one of those propaganda bites that has been generated. You can look very easily at who benefited most from the quote-unquote failed coup or staged coup, and that is Erdogan himself. You can compare the lifestyles of the two individuals to get a sense of their ethical grounding. Mr. Gulen has always lived in very modest, simple arrangements. He owns nothing. A few books, some soil from all of the places where he lived in Turkey, lives in a one-bedroom apartment in a retreat center. Mr. Erdogan built for himself an 1,100-room palace in Ankara. And he clearly is the one who benefited from the coup event. He called it, in fact, the day after, a gift from God. To accuse this religious leader, who's consistently been an advocate of nonviolence, who himself was a victim of previous military coups, of staging a coup from the Pocono Mountains,
That's where he lives right now, by the way, the Poconos.
Yes,
yeah.
Right.
And why, by the way, why is he there?
Yeah.
I tend to think of that as a place where people just go for the weekend.
Honeymoon.
Or their honeymoon, yeah.
Sure. Some Turkish immigrants close to him purchased some land there in the 1970s, I want to say. I can't recall exactly. As a summer camp. And had been meeting there with their families, bringing Turkish immigrants from all over the country to this place for, they called it the Chestnut Camp. And gradually it evolved, and they put a couple buildings up, and it's now the retreat center where he lives. So it's merely a matter of, you know, acquaintance and convenience. This is how the Hizmet movement has grown. It's organic. It's through relationships that are based on trust. He really has inspired people to work really hard, to trust each other, because he's a faithful Muslim who also translates that faith for the modern world.
Do you share that faith?
No, I'm a Christian. I'm a pastor of a church in Green Bay and a professor at a Lutheran seminary in Philadelphia, so I'm an outsider.
What led you to write the definitive book on Gulen?
Huh.
What drew you to the material?
Yeah, the previous book that I published was a book on religion and violence in the U.S. It was a painful book to write. It's difficult to see religion, which exists to provide people with peace and inspire acts of love, be perverted. I was working on a book on religious peace building entitled A Coming Religious Peace, because I truly believe across the globe, people of faith are from the grassroots working together and have a vision of cooperation. I discovered Mr. Gulen in 2006, and the more I read about him, the more I realized he belonged in the company of these peace builders. And just gradually, as I came closer to people inspired by him, I realized that this was a biography that needed to be done.
In the U.S., as you've pointed out, Gulen has ties to dozens of schools that have thrived in recent years, as I mentioned, including the River City Science Academy in Jacksonville, consistently a top-ranked school.
Yep.
Schools in other countries as well. Parents love these schools. Students are thriving at these schools. That said, there has been some criticism of the way these schools have proliferated. A 60 Minutes investigation in particular looked at how employees are brought over on visas to staff the schools. So what's your response to that?
Yeah, the schools are doing some extraordinary work in some of the poorest neighborhoods in the U.S. and around the globe. The commitment to educate the younger generation is a sacred vocation for Mr. Gulen and for the people inspired by him. The pattern of bringing people over to work in the schools is comparable to what the Italians did or the Poles et cetera. I mean, you know, immigrant groups do this. That is, they work within. And it's truly extraordinary, actually, how open the schools have been. They've been investigated time after time after time after time, and nothing's been discovered other than excellence. And that's consistent with the commitment, the ethical commitments and the spiritual commitments, really, that inspire people without being heavy-handed, right? Islam is present there by example, not as something that's coercive, just by the ethical commitments of the teachers. And that changes the entire culture. And I've seen this all over the world. In Tanzania, for instance, in Dar es Salaam, I was there a couple months ago visiting the school. And 80% of the teachers are Tanzanian. So the school's, you know, infusing the economy as well as, you know, preparing students with really good math and science educations in places all over the globe. It's quite a story, actually. As a historian, it's fascinating to be a part of it.
Now, have you heard from Fethullah Gulen since publishing your book?
I haven't heard directly from him, but I have heard from people close to him that he appreciates it, which is, of course, very gratifying to me.
What's the most common question you get asked about him?
I often get asked, you know, what my impression was when I met him. And I had, you know, I waited until I had a complete manuscript done before I sat down with him because I wanted to be objective. That is to, you know, go through the evidence, weigh the evidence accurately. And I didn't want to waste his time. So when I met him, I was actually a little worried. I mean, you know, I've worked on this book for 8 years. What if now I meet the guy and he's a jerk, you know? Fortunately, that proved not to be the case. He's actually a very gentle, thoughtful, present individual. I mean, he's just, there's a there about him.
So you were relieved.
Pardon me?
You were relieved.
I was relieved, yeah. 8 years of my life not spent, you know, down the tubes.
Yeah, I bet. Well, it's such a pleasure to meet you. And this is a preview of the talk that John will be giving tonight. You need to come on downtown and join Dr. John Paul as he discusses his book, Fethullah Gulen, A Life of Hizmet. He'll be speaking at the Main Library in downtown Jacksonville tonight at 5:30 p.m., a talk and discussion. This program is free, open to the public, and it is certainly timely. So Dr. John Paul, author of Fethullah Gulen, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us this morning on the show. We really appreciate you being here.
It was my pleasure to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
Again, that's tonight at 5:30 at the Main Library on Hemming Park. A quick break, and then up next, the growth of this city's green chamber of commerce. As businesses see green in more ways than one, that's in our Going Green right after this. You're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9. Back in a moment.
Cypress Village, a continuing care retirement community, features apartments and homes surrounded by lakes and walking trails, minutes from the beach and adjacent to Mayo Clinic. 901-4222. More at lifecare.brookdale.com. Tune in to First Coast Connect this Thursday to Around Town for a look at what's happening around Jacksonville. sponsored in part by St. Augustine Distillery.
I'm Carol Hills. House Democrats say they're sending the articles of impeachment to the Senate.
He violated the Constitution in such a way that could not be ignored.
We know how weak this impeachment is. I think the president is above it all.
But it's not just about domestic politics. U.S. national security is at the heart of the matter. The global perspective on impeachment, next time on The World.
Weekday afternoons at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
A team of researchers paid dozens of women in Mexico to get artificially inseminated so their embryos could be flushed out of their bodies and analyzed. The research is raising ethical concerns.
What this essentially does is using a woman's body as a petri dish.
I'm Audie Cornish. That story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Does Mitch McConnell have the 51 votes in the Senate to hold a quick trial with no witnesses? Republicans appear to be shifting on the rules for an upcoming trial. The president wants his party to dismiss the charges against him. I'm Todd Zwillick. Who will be heard and who's ready to listen? That's next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
This Going Green segment is made possible by A1A Solar.
Welcome back. They're a business group focused on sustainability, and they're growing all the time. The Northeast Florida Green Chamber has both a new directory and a big coming out party, and the dress code is green tie. What does that mean? Well, Christina Kelkors is executive director of the Northeast Florida Green Chamber, and she's here now. Hey, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Thanks so much for joining us. So you are celebrating the one-year anniversary of the North Florida Green Chamber by having a big bash, a green tie affair. So what is green tie?
Right. It's we wanted to celebrate our 1 year with a black tie event, but we felt it was appropriate to call it a green tie, which is actually a semi-formal event to celebrate our one-year anniversary.
Really exciting. And in the year that you have been around, you've grown quite a bit. You are part of the U.S. Green Chamber of Commerce. What's the mission?
Our mission is actually very simple. It's to make being green cool and convenient for North Florida. And what we mean by that is cool, we want to make it valued. We feel that this area needs to value sustainability and resiliency from our business owners. It needs to be something of value. And convenient, we see it as our job to make it easier for businesses to do just that.
You even have a green business pledge on your website, and you invite businesses to take it. If they take the pledge, what does that mean they have to do?
They don't have to do anything, but we do hope that they pledge to take some actions each year to bring their business to a new level of sustainability. And it is free for anybody who wants to take it. You don't have to be a Green Chamber member, and it's found throughout our website. You can find a link for it.
What are some easy ways a business can become more sustainable and get more in line with this mission?
You can join the Green Chamber.
That's number one, right?
Well, one of the things when you do join the Green Chamber, one of our benefits to members is we have a group of sustainability coaches that are vetted, and we know that their certifications are valid, and they give you a free session when you become a Green Chamber member to walk through the Green Business Pledge. That's an amazing benefit for any Green Chamber member, and that will actually help you. Every business is different, so the specific coach coming to see your specific business will help you move in the right direction.
And this is good for the other kind of green, the bottom line. As you say on your website, 78% of consumers say they will go out of their way or pay more for a product if they know that business is socially or environmentally responsible. Consumers have increased sustainable product sales by 20% over the last few years. So with that in mind, you have another big announcement to mention this morning. You have a new green marketplace directory on your website.
We do. We're very proud of our launch of our Green Marketplace, which is an online directory of green businesses. So you can find it now on our website, and we'll be making a formal launch and showing at our Green Tie Affair.
This is everything from animal care to communications and tech, construction, education, entertainment and event planning, financial services, health and wellness, legal, manufacturing, food, retail, you name it.
Any industry. And the idea was part of why the Green Chamber, I think, exists. I think consumers, as you mentioned, 78% of people want to support environmentally responsible businesses. They don't always know where to find them. The Green Chamber is a source for that. And our Green Marketplace is going to be the place to go to find. If you want to get your hair done and you want to go to a place with less chemicals, you go to hair care on our Green Marketplace and type in your zip code, and it tells you where the green hair companies are.
That's such a great resource. So go to the website now. It's NorthFloridaGreenChamber.org. NorthFloridaGreenChamber.org. As they celebrate 1 year on the First Coast, and their big bash is coming up next Thursday night, January 23rd, the Green Tie Affair. So how can people be part of that?
Well, tickets are available, and there's a limited number, so try to go today. The limited number on the website is easy to reach. It's under events, Green Tie Affair, and you just register there. If you're a Green Chamber member, you have to log in and get your tickets, and if you're not, you just click the register button, and there you go.
And fellas, you don't have to wear a green tie.
Although we recommend it.
You could. The attire is
semi-formal.
So I think most people know what that means. It's going to be a great event with discussions around resiliency, green innovation, networking, and delicious food. This is at 927 Events downtown. Chef Chris, who is affiliated with 927, I know will cater a delicious evening. So mark your calendar for Thursday, January 23rd at the North Florida Green Chamber's Green Tie Affair. Check them out online and check out the Green Marketplace too. Christina Kelkors is doing amazing work leading the Northeast Florida Green Chamber of Commerce. And we're so pleased to spotlight you on our Going Green segment today. So Christina, I'll see you at the event. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Melissa. Have a great day.
You too. And that is our show. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Michelle Corum is our show director. Jessica Palumbo is the station news director. Bill Bortsfield is our digital editor. And you're always a big part of what we do. Keep those emails coming to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And if you missed anything from today's show, catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. We'll be right back here again tomorrow at 9 a.m. Let's connect again then.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.